entrance of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, killing a Palestinian man and his son. According to the health ministry, at least 60 Palestinians were killed across Gaza in a matter of 24 hours. The regime resumed its onslaught on Gaza on March the 18th, shattering a two-month ceasefire. The death toll from the Israeli genocide is nearing 50,700, with over 115,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier with the latest updates on the renewed Israeli attacks on the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
Let me say that a brutal attack took place here in Deir al-Balah city in the vicinity of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital here that targeted a Palestinian civilian alongside his son. And he was, as you know, Salman Abid. And by the way, he's the cousin of our correspondent, Abu Bakr Abid, here. So I would like to seize this opportunity and express my deep condolences to our brother Abu Bakr over this loss of his cousin. In the meantime, when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli occupation forces continue their brutal and genocidal attacks against Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhood, whereas the Israeli attacks are still ongoing amid the military operation, which is still taking place. They're targeting more Palestinian civilians for the third consecutive day, and those attacks have never ceased for a while. We are talking about more Palestinian civilians are still slaughtered, while the Israeli occupation forces are still expanding their military operation, targeting more neighborhoods and more streets in Ash-Shuja'iyya neighborhood. And in addition to that, several residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli fighter jets over the past couple of hours in Az-Zaytun neighborhood. Needless to mention as well that we are talking about at least four Palestinian civilians were slaughtered in Bi' Hanun city in the northern Gaza Strip after they were targeted by the Israeli fighter drones. All in all, we can say clearly that the Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying their brutal and deadly attacks against the Palestinian people, while on the ground the Palestinian people are still devastated with the brutal measures taken by the Israeli occupation force.
The United Nations Children's Fund has slammed Israel for depriving more than 1 million children in Gaza of life-saving assistance for more than a month. In a statement on the occasion of Palestinian Children's Day, UNICEF said the continued blockade of aid supply to Gaza constitutes a violation of international humanitarian law and has dire consequences for children. It added that the continued prevention of aid delivery has exacerbated malnutrition and spread of diseases while increasing child mortality rate in Gaza. UNICEF said there is enough formula milk for only 400 children for a month. It stressed that infant food supplies are being depleted as thousands of aid packages remain stalled behind Gaza's closed crossings. The agency warned that children receiving treatment for malnutrition are at grave risk due to the blockade of Gaza. It said the closure of malnutrition treatment centers since the resumption of the Israeli aggression on March the 18th threatens the lives of hundreds of children relying on these centers. A video is circulating online showing Israeli forces firing on a group of Palestinian paramedics in Gaza's southern city of Rafah. The footage was found on the phone of one of the paramedics who worked for Gaza's Civil Defense and Palestine Red Crescent Society. The video was filmed on March 23rd. The medics were on a rescue mission in Rafah's Tel al-Sultan neighborhood when the attack happened. Their ambulances and fire trucks were clearly marked and had their emergency lights on as they came under fire. At least 15 paramedics were killed in the strike. Hamas has strongly condemned the attack, saying the video is proof of yet another war crime in the regime's genocidal campaign against Palestinians. The resistance group said the video captures the deliberate, cold-blooded slaughter of civil defense teams. Hamas said the video is irrefutable visual evidence which exposes Israel's lies, proves the systematic targeting of humanitarian workers, and constitutes premeditated murder under international law. Gaza's civil defense has also called for an international probe into the execution-style killing of the medics and aid workers. The violent Israeli attack on rescue teams in Gaza's Rafah continues to draw condemnations. Palestinian Red Crescent Society spokesperson Nibal Farsakh has rejected the regime's narrative and demanded an immediate investigation to ensure justice for the victims.
Although ambulances carried the internationally protected emblem and had their lights turned on, the occupation soldiers deliberately opened fire hysterically on the ambulance team, whose members were also wearing Red Crescent uniforms, and this led to the martyrdom of the teams. This video clearly and openly refutes the story presented by the occupation, which deliberately targets ambulances along with medical and health personnel. The occupation is telling a false story. The occupation has told the world that its forces targeted ambulances that were moving suspiciously without their lights on, and accuses them, as usual, with the same fabricated narrative that they belong to Hamas. This is not the first targeting of the society's teams. 27 members of the Red Crescent Society have been killed by Israeli forces while performing their humanitarian duties and while wearing the Red Crescent badge. Today, we, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, call on the international community to conduct an immediate and independent investigation that ensures justice for the victims and holds accountable all those involved in this crime.
Israeli settlers have once again taken to the streets of Tel Aviv for another weekly demonstration demanding the release of all remaining captives held in Gaza. The protesters called on the cabinet of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to put the captives above other interests. They also urged the regime to stop violating the Gaza ceasefire deal with Hamas. Demonstrators chanted anti-war slogans calling for an immediate end to the Gaza genocide. The new rallies came amid a rise in demonstrations across the occupied territories and increasing discontent with the resumption of Israel's onslaught on Gaza. The regime restarted the Gaza attacks after refusing to enter talks on the second phase of the ceasefire deal. Israel sought an extension of the first phase of the deal, but Hamas rejected that as a violation of the original agreement. The movement says it will only release the remaining captives in exchange for the release of more Palestinian prisoners, a permanent ceasefire, and Israel's pullout from Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces say they have targeted the U.S. aircraft carrier Harry S. Truman and its accompanying warships in the Red Sea with drones and missiles.
In recent hours, the missile force and drone unit, with support from the naval forces, engaged several U.S. warships in the northern Red Sea, including the U.S. aircraft carrier Truman, using a number of cruise missiles and drones. The hours-long attack operation disrupted the enemy's ability to carry out hostile assaults on our country during the period of the strike. Additionally, the naval forces of the armed forces carried out a military operation targeting the U.S. supply ship accompanying the Truman aircraft carrier with a ballistic missile.
Yahya Sari emphasized that Yemen's leadership, people, and armed forces are committed to defending the Palestinian people as a religious, moral, and humanitarian duty. He said operations against Israel and Israeli-linked ships will continue until the regime's aggression against Gaza ends and the territory's blockade is lifted. The new operation came after Yemeni forces targeted an Israeli military site in the occupied Palestinian territories using a drone. Additionally, Yemen's air defenses shot down a U.S. reconnaissance drone over Saada province with a domestically produced surface-to-air missile. The United States presses ahead with its aggression against Yemen, launching new airstrikes on various areas across the Arab country. According to Yemeni media, the latest strikes by American warplanes targeted the Hafsin area west of Saada city with four raids. The attacks hit a store selling solar energy panels and a civilian home west of the city. Two civilians have been killed and four others injured in the strikes. Footage of the incident shows civil defense teams carrying out rescue operations and working to extinguish fires caused by the bombings. American warplanes also carried out at least five strikes east of the city of Saada. The U.S. and its allies have escalated their aggression against Yemen after the country resumed its anti-Israel operations over the regime's renewed genocide in Gaza. Most of the U.S. attacks target civilian buildings, causing fatalities and injuries among civilian population. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Mowry, joined us earlier to bring us up to speed on the latest U.S. strikes on Yemen and the country's response to them.
I think it's sending a clear message to the U.S. and to the Trump administration that has declared goals of eliminating the Yemeni armed forces eliminating their ability to impose a naval blockade on Israeli shipments has really failed and failed across the board. You talk about the U.S. economy drastically taking a turn for the worse. Well, when you add to the mix that they've also lost over $1 billion in just 3 weeks of military operations, because the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its military objectives, now they want to go to Plan B. And experts here in Yemen suspect that the U.S. is trying to cause pockets of famine. They're trying to stir the nation into another humanitarian catastrophe similar to one that was endured here in Yemen from 2015 to 2018 during the Saudi-led coalition. But the Yemeni army and the armed forces, they assure everyone and the world that a humanitarian catastrophe, a deterioration of Yemen's economy and fabric of society will not be denigrated, because they've taken the precautionary measures over the past years to ensure that even if an all-out war was to be directed at Yemen, people will not starve to death.
Protesters have flooded Washington, D.C. and cities across the U.S. in what is anticipated to be the largest single day of protests against U.S. President Donald Trump since his return to office. Demonstrators held signs that read, "Not my president," condemning the president's executive orders, including his attacks on Social Security, harsh trade measures, and alliance with billionaires like Elon Musk. Events have been planned in all 50 states, as well as in Canada and Mexico. Pro-Palestine protesters are also joining the rallies to slam the U.S. support for the Israeli regime's renewed genocide in Gaza and the Trump administration's crackdown on campus protests. Meanwhile, rallies are also taking place in Berlin, Paris, London, and Lisbon in support of the nationwide protests in the U.S.
Paris against Trump! Paris against Trump! Paris against Trump!
Hundreds, mostly Americans, are marching on the streets of Europe, voicing concern over the state of democracy in their country. In Paris, expats branded Trump a racist con man, while Berliners slammed Elon Musk's role in slashing government safeguards. Trump was inaugurated for a second time on January 20th. Almost immediately afterwards, he wielded sweeping executive orders to enact a radical conservative vision known as Project 2025, which centralizes authority and dismantles liberal institutions. Now, to talk more on this, let's cross over to Kitchener, Ontario, where we have Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, with us. Mr. Fantina, your thoughts on these mass rallies across the U.S. in all 50 states, as well as Canada and Mexico, and even a handful of European countries. And also, what is Trump's real plan?
A lot worse than people expected him to be. Now, his spokespeople say he has this overwhelming mandate to carry out his policies. He won less than 50% of the vote, so it's hardly an overwhelming mandate. But these protests in the United States and around the world are because of his tariffs, because of the cuts that Elon Musk is doing through his so-called Department of Government Efficiency, which is simply taking an axe to government agencies and offices and cutting people arbitrarily and indiscriminately, which is going to negatively affect the services that people in the United States are receiving. And the tariffs, of course, are impacting people around the world, not only in the United States. Trump's goal in all this is, as the protesters are saying, is to benefit the millionaires and billionaires that are in his cabinet, that are his closest associates, such as Elon Musk. But if you look at most of his cabinet members are at least multimillionaires, if not billionaires, and they're completely out of touch with the normal voter, the regular voter in the United States. So this idea that that Trump can act as a dictator, which he is doing, these executive orders are supposed to be for emergency situations. He has now signed over 100 of them, which is either more than or very close to what Joe Biden signed in a four-year period, and it's been just a few months with Donald Trump. So his goal is to be a king, be a dictator, and ram through laws in the United States that are damaging to the people, that are damaging the economy because he simply doesn't care about them. He cares about pleasing his rich supporters, and we know he loves it when people bow down to him and admire him and respect him, which is why world leaders manipulate him so easily. But what we're seeing around the world now is people saying, this is enough, this has to stop, and they're doing something about it.
There you have it, Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. Mr. Fantina, it's always nice talking to you, sir. Thank you for your time. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care, and bye-bye for now.
The Zionist regime is committing yet another war crime against Palestinians in Gaza, but the Western news coverage distorts reality, downplaying its atrocities through omission and spin. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, a ceasefire does not mean that Israel has dropped its goal to annihilate Gaza. The mission remains the same, and the war crimes endure, including killings. The method just shifts. Now, the textbook starvation of the enclave is the weapon of choice. But the British public will not be privy to such details, not if they rely on the mainstream media to report them accurately. In early March, as the first phase of the ceasefire was ending and the full withdrawal of the Zionist regime's forces from Gaza was supposed to take place, the Zionist regime decided to block all aid from entering the territory. The media reported it, but characteristically thinned out the details. Israel is stopping all aid into Gaza, reported the Sky News. Israel blocks entry of all humanitarian aid into Gaza, read the online BBC headline. LBC's article stated, Israel halts all aid and supplies coming into Gaza. Missing from every outlet was the crucial added context. As concluded by Human Rights Watch, HRW, this was a flagrant violation of international law. Legal experts confirmed it constitute a genocidal act. But the tried and tested strategy of propaganda by omission reigned supreme. Why provide the intricate details and allow readers to connect the dots about Israel's cruelty when the key information can simply be suppressed? Within days, Israeli regime officials were threatening to cut off electricity and water completely, imposing a total siege on Gaza, while continuing to displace more Palestinians from northern Gaza. The Telegraph reported this proposal as a hell plan, yet it apparently did not occur to journalists, researchers, or editors at the outlet to mention that Israel was threatening another complete siege of Gaza and further Palestinian ethnic cleansing. The best right-wing broadcast could muster was to call Israel's intended crime provocative, not because of the humanitarian catastrophe it would cause, but because it would take place during Ramadan. Even at the supposedly progressive Independent and Guardian, the same skewed rules of engagement applied. They could have noted that the International Criminal Court already has arrest warrants for starvation crimes against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, or they could have mentioned that deliberately starving Gaza would violate the International Court of Justice orders to prevent genocide. Even a simple acknowledgement that Israel was committing repeat war crimes would have sufficed. Instead, both newspapers framed Israel's latest violation of international law with a softened touch. The Guardian's subheading presented it as a negotiation tactic to pressure the resistance movement Hamas into releasing more captives, as though that somehow justified or legitimized the looming atrocity. On March 9th, the Zionist regime cut off electricity to Gaza as planned. In a social media post, Israel's energy minister confirmed he had signed an order to cut off electricity to the Gaza Strip immediately. "Enough with the talk. It's time for action," he declared. "Israel cuts off electricity supply to Gaza," wrote the BBC. LBC's online article provided the most depth, writing, "Israel cuts off electricity supply to Gaza, affecting drinking water 1 week after blocking humanitarian aid." Yet even this article stopped short of clarifying the crime it constituted. In both broadcast and print media, some outlets opted for headlines that framed Israel's cutting off power as a pressure tactic and amplified its justification. Sky News declared, "Israel cuts power to Gaza after Hamas refuses to extend first phase of ceasefire." The article included UN criticism of the Zionist regime for collective punishment immediately followed by Israel's denial. Both were given equal weight, as if this were merely a matter of conflicting opinions rather than a documented crime. "It was to force Hamas to return hostages," claimed The Telegraph. The Guardian described Israel's systematic starvation campaign as an apparent effort to force the hand of Hamas. When The Independent and The Times cited concerns from the British government about Israel's actions, the violation of international law was framed only as a possibility, as though there were still room for debate. In its broadcast output, the BBC's correspondent described in vivid detail the cruelty of Israel's actions before stating that it will add to the accusations that Israel is committing war crimes again. By framing it as a mere accusation or allegation, the BBC introduced an element of deniability, subtly deflecting from an incontestable reality. "There is nothing to speculate about or second class. Israel's strategy has been clear and consistent throughout." In December 2023, HRW concluded that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war and committing the crime against humanity of extermination. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem declared that Israel was deliberately manufacturing famine, while the United Nations confirmed that Israel was knowingly imposing life-threatening conditions on Gaza's population. "The illegality of these actions, collective punishment and starvation as a method of warfare, is not up for debate," yet the media continued to shroud them in vague, detached language. At first glance, this reporting may seem harmless. Some might even call it neutral and impartial, the very essence of journalism. But the meticulous, consistent whitewashing of Israel's crime is as deliberate as it is dangerous. The public is steered towards conclusions that reflect only fragments of reality, leaving them misinformed. When the Zionist regime imposes a crippling siege and starves an entire territory, the severity of the crime must be emphasized, not the perpetrator's narrative. It must be made clear that Israel's ability to impose such policies stems from its status as an illegal occupying force. These details matter. When they are obscured, an artificial balance is prioritized. Israel's barbarity is subtly sanitized. The linguistic tools employed by the mainstream media, amounting to propaganda by omission, shape whether the public sees Gaza as enduring genocide under Israel's colonial conquest or as merely part of a conflict between two warring sites. And therein lies the fundamental goal. After all, this is the same media ecosystem in which the national broadcaster described the murder of 6-year-old Tan Rajab, killed when Israeli regime tanks fired 335 bullets into her car as she waited for an ambulance, as her having been found dead. It was Sky News that framed Israel's illegal detention, torture and abuse of Dr. Hossam Abu Safi as merely holding him. It was The Guardian that referred to Israeli settlers preparing to seize land in Gaza for ethnic cleansing as merely preparing to move there. Now, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, already starving, endlessly displaced, and without adequate shelter, are being suffocated further, denied life-saving supplies and mediation by Israel's illegal blockade. The Zionist regime officials vow to make Gaza a place where no human can exist. And the state policy is working as intended, all in the knowledge that the mainstream media will ensure the public remains insulated. The iconic British Palestinian reconstructive surgeon Ghassan Abu Seteh poignantly remarked, "When we have a museum for the genocide, we will have a special place for the journalists who were the enablers." Those words have never rung truer, highlighting the undeniable reality that the mainstream media is not just complicit, but an active participant in Israel's oppression of the Palestinians.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, concern for others. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab on Ivy English Radio. So, topic is concern for others, and obviously this is a very broad topic, and I'm going to try and narrow it down to particular sorts of, let's say, scenarios, maybe just to make it a bit easier to talk about it. I'm using example of just a particular attitude of one of our famous martyrs, His Eminence the Sayyid. So it's said about him that he was always thinking about other people. So, for example, he'd always be thinking basically about his troops, about the fighters, no matter what he was doing. So, for example, if he was sitting down, and this is the way it was narrated by one of his sons. So he would literally if he was eating bread with yogurt, he might be sitting there and literally sort of asking and wondering, I wonder how the fighters are doing. What are they eating? What's their meal? And it's also commented that most likely the fighters were eating a more substantial, sort of slightly more special meal than the Sayyid was. And even, for example, when he was making wudu, he'd also be sort of wondering about, oh, what sort of facilities are there for the fighters, for the troops to be able to make their wudu easily enough. And you know, this is a particular way of, this is a particular mindset. So not only, and obviously this mindset is rooted in piety. This is rooted in just basically being the best servant of Allah. And obviously the, and that's for obviously, and I would say that the nafs, these things that we want for ourselves, these desires that we want for ourselves, they sort of have been burnt away almost. And I think this is a terminology maybe some of us scholars use. So we can sort of basically destroy the nafs, that ego that always wants. And I'll talk about this a bit more. Welcome back. This is A to Z and Arabic English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about concern for others, and I've just used the example of His Eminence the Sayyid, how he was always thinking, always concerned about other people, for example, the troops, the fighters, what they were doing, whether things were easy for them. And obviously this is the idea. We can do this when we've sort of defeated our ego. Because while we're still caught up in what our ego wants, or maybe our ego just wants to have this nice meal, or maybe our ego is saying to us, oh, go out and buy this thing, please, I want this thing. And you can imagine, if you just think about it logically, any time that we are thinking about something that we want, there is time that we can't be busy thinking about others, and we also can't be busy thinking about Allah. Now, obviously, everything, in a sense, Allah doesn't need us anyway. Allah's in no need. But obviously, one way of serving Allah for us as human beings is to serve the others, serve humanity, serve the Ummah, serve the fellow believers. So having this constant concern for others is, in a sense, a very good manifestation, a great example of how we can achieve this. And obviously, it's not just this idea of defeating the ego. Obviously, we have a sort of level of empathy and kindness and obviously concern for brotherhood, sisterhood, that is obviously exemplary. So this sort of selflessness is something that, you know, maybe we can even develop as a habit in ourselves, those of us who are not at that high level. And for sure, because we know, look, if we maybe just make it a habit of ours every day, to just consciously, and even though maybe we're doing lots of dhikr of Allah, but maybe if every day we can also train ourselves to think about maybe some of the people in our family, you know, what are they doing, what are they in need of, and do that day by day, and maybe that can become more of a trait in us too, inshallah. So I pray that you gain some extra points or insights from today, and look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AZ here on IB English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
A Danish company has sold up its entire stake in Tesla, citing concerns over Elon Musk's leadership, labor rights, governance, and political behavior. Tesla's shares have plunged about 50% since a high reached after the U.S. presidential elections last November. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The website Dagens.com has covered this story and tells us more. One of Denmark's largest pension funds, Akademiker Pension, has officially blacklisted Tesla and sold off all of its shares in the automaker, citing concerns over Elon Musk's leadership, labor rights violations, and problematic corporate governance. Akademik Pensioners' chief executive officer, Jens Munch Holst, told the Bloomberg news agency, "Our patience has run out." He explained that the decision was driven by growing unease over Elon Musk's behavior and Tesla's direction under his management. "In short, it is our view that Elon Musk is destroying Tesla's brand and value," Jens Munch Holst emphasized. Academica Pension pointed to three main reasons behind its divestment decision. First, Elon Musk's political statements. Second, Tesla's lack of transparency and clarity in corporate governance. And third, the company's ongoing disregard for workers' rights to unionize. The fund, which manages over $22 billion, previously held a significant stake in Tesla, worth up to $72 million at its peak. The final shares have now been sold, though it's not yet known how much was lost in the process. The decision comes amid mounting labor tensions over Tesla, particularly the company's year-long dispute with Swedish union IF Metall. The conflict has attracted solidarity from other Scandinavian unions, including in Denmark, and is starting to resonate with institutional investors in the region. Across the Öresund, Sweden's seventh national pension fund has also raised concerns. Mikael Lindhok, the press manager at Sweden's seventh national pension fund, said, "This is a worrying development we are seeing around Tesla. It cannot be ruled out that the seventh national pension fund will blacklist the company if other measures have no effect," though Sweden's seventh national pension fund has not yet made a formal move. It is currently reviewing its ownership strategy and how to respond. There is a growing debate in the Nordic region over Tesla. While some funds, like Academica Pension, are choosing full divestment, others remain cautious. LO, the Danish Confederation of Trade Unions, expressed a more reserved stance, emphasizing the role of ongoing engagement through shareholder ethics councils. Jens Lundberg, LO's press manager, said, "We trust the ethical council to do its job, but we are of course following developments. The more time that passes in the conflict, the less appropriate it becomes to have ownership." Tesla's failing stock price adds financial context to the ethical concerns. The company's market value has dropped by nearly 50% since its peak, a staggering loss of nearly $8 trillion in value. Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story. Danish pension fund Academica Pension is blacklisting Tesla Inc., citing the company's record on workers' rights, as well as the growing risk posed by the actions of Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk. Patience has a way of running out at some point, Academica Pension Chief Executive Officer Jens Munch-Holst said on Friday. He added, "We've now reached that point when it comes to Tesla." The fund, which oversees more than $20 billion of assets, is selling the remaining 200 Tesla shares it still holds and placing the company on its exclusion list, meaning neither it nor its external managers can buy Tesla shares. According to an email statement, Academica Pension's Tesla stake was worth 300 million kroners or $45 million at its peak, according to a spokesperson for the fund. Tesla sales have plummeted in Europe amid signs that consumers in Europe are balking at efforts by Elon Musk, the company's chief executive officer, to interfere in their elections by praising far-right candidates. Against that backdrop, the company's shares have plunged about 50% since a high reached after the U.S. presidential elections last November, wiping out more than $750 billion off Tesla's market value. Jens Munch-Holst, the chief executive officer of Academica Pension, who recently pulled a mandate worth 3.3 billion kroner from State Street Global Advisors due to concerns about its faltering climate commitments, said Tesla has long been a leader in the green transition. But despite that track record, it's hard to stay invested in the company, he said, given the list of problems for which there is no prospect of improvement. Academica Pension's decision to sell off all of its Tesla shares rests on three factors: Tesla's year-long efforts to fight workers' rights, its governance issues, and Elon Musk stepping into American and European politics and spreading misinformation, Holst said. This latter point has created considerable risk of return, he said. Holst added, in short, it's our view that Elon Musk is in the process of destroying Tesla's brand and value.
Welcome to the Israel Watch. Hebrew media focused on the aggression against Gaza in light of Netanyahu's proposal for a captive exchange deal and the plan by Netanyahu's administration to displace Gaza's residents as well as internal Israeli divisions. We discuss these topics with Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst. Hello and welcome, Dr. Omar, to this episode. Hebrew media analyzed Netanyahu's proposal, and some commentators doubted that Hamas would accept it, despite its openness to the Egyptian initiative. Dr. Omar, where is Netanyahu taking things? In your own opinion, do you think he would derail any kind of negotiation, despite Hamas's openness to the Egyptian proposal, to the latest Egyptian proposal?
I mean, every day, more than the day before, it's very clear that the plan is to do a genocide in Gaza.
Yes.
And the objective of the genocide is to kill everybody. I mean, this is what a genocide is defined. It's defined as killing all the population that's there and depriving the Palestinians from livelihood in this part of the world. He wants to take control of Gaza without its population. Now, this is what he wants. Now, how does he get there? He gets there by lying and by trying to deceive the whole world by saying that he is into the agreement, which has two phases. We finished the first phase. He didn't start the second phase. He wants to delay it. He wants to find any twisted arguments to actually come up with some ideas.
Now, excuses.
Yes, excuses, definitely. And he wants to try to continue the bombing and expand the bombing, especially during Eid.
Yes.
We have this is a holy month of Ramadan. This is a time when people, you know, it's the holiest time in Islam for all Muslims. Children are, you know, trying to celebrate Ramadan, and they're being slaughtered and killed with their with the clothes of the Eid. This is tragic. I mean, he's targeting ambulances, trying to show more aggression, more violence.
That reflects what
so that
you're highlighting, that this is a genocide and a complete genocide, and that's how a genocide looks like. The Israeli commentator in the report, Dr. Omar, believes that the second phase of the agreement remains a sticking point for Netanyahu's administration. Do you think that without the second phase, this agreement will not be moving forward?
Definitely. Well, there was an agreement, and they agreed to it, and there are supposed to be guarantees for the agreement, which are the United States and, you know, and the Qatar and Egypt, which is, you know, and they're supposed to pressure the Israelis so that we can start phase two in the negotiations. This is what Hamas wants. This is what Hamas announced. Now, the commentator said that, you know, the Hamas has been showing like this kind of pacifist approach towards the Egyptian
yes.
initiative. Well, the Hamas has always been very, you know, positive about anything that comes from the Egyptians, because they hold on to remaining on good terms with the Egyptians, with the Qataris, so that the negotiations can continue in the future. That doesn't mean, however,
but
that
the
Hamas
Israelis
would comply.
Are saying, or the cabinet, or Netanyahu's cabinet, is always highlighting and saying that the Hamas are the ones that are keeping obstacles in the way of this agreement.
Well, that's a complete illusion. In fact, Hamas, from the beginning, even before these negotiations started, Hamas was ready to have a full, comprehensive exchange of all the prisoners of war. From day one. That is in 2023. I mean, like, this is like almost 2 years ago, and Hamas never changed its position. Its position is very clear. It's ready to negotiate and to exchange. However, no one would expect Hamas or anyone else to commit suicide by accepting terms that will lead to its annihilation.
Okay.
That's not possible.
Do we stay in Gaza, where criticism within Israel is escalating against Netanyahu's administration for breaking the ceasefire agreement, as we are highlighting, in both Gaza and Lebanon? A former Knesset member held Netanyahu fully responsible for what she called the return of fighting in Gaza and Lebanon. Dr. Amar, we want to actually understand why all this is happening. A major question is asked. Domestic political calculations, the Israelis in Israel, is this what is banning, or this is what is not allowing Netanyahu to come to a straight decision here and just escalating in all sides?
I think within the Israeli entities population, there are some divisions. The Netanyahu camp believes in violent deterrent techniques. He believes that more blood, more killing, more destruction, you know, will lead to positive results. That he wants to pressure Hamas, pressure the whole world, saying that Israel can kill anyone, can burn, can do a genocide. Nobody's gonna do anything about
he
it.
He still
and you'll
believes
have to,
that after all
I
what
think
happened?
He still believes that. And I think many Israelis still believe that. So what the problem is, and this member of Knesset, and this Israeli person,
mm-hmm.
has the other perspective, the perspective that, no, when we do a peace, talks with the adversaries or the enemies of Israel, when we reach an agreement for ceasefire, this ceasefire agreement must be respected.
Okay.
Clearly, the Netanyahu cabinet and the Netanyahu administration is not respecting any agreement. This will make the Israeli entity lose what's left of its credibility in the international community also. And it will show that the Israelis are liars, simply. Mm-hmm. They just want to continue with the bloodshed, with the genocide. They want to continue slaughtering innocent people, innocent civilians, everywhere in southern Lebanon and in Yemen also, and in Gaza and the West Bank.
Okay.
And this is ongoing. This is what the Israelis... The Israelis
because
more than ever...
Because they do have a green light from the United States.
Yes, but they're showing
forward,
more than ever.
Ahmad.
They're showing the whole world more than ever that they survive based on bloodshed. They survive based on killing other people. No nation or no entity in the world can exist that is founded on the killing of others.
And I think that became obvious to most people. And now, dear viewers, to the plan to displace Gaza's residents, which Netanyahu's administration has put in place and is being heavily promoted in Hebrew media, alongside claims that a large number of Gaza residents want to leave, as we will see.
יש יציאה מעזה בדרכים שונות, גם בנושא הזה וגם בנושא של ההפגנות, יש לי תחינה חרישית שמישהו בישראל סוף סוף יסתום את הפה. פשוט ניתן לדברים להיות, לעשות את שלהם, בלי יותר מדי יחץ ובלי, זה לתת לתהליכים להיות בלי השפעה ישראלית. יש רצון גדול לצאת מעזה, סקר שפורסם בעיתון הבריטי טלגרף, על ידי מכון גלופ, אומר שמחצית מהאוכלוסייה רוצה לצאת, בין אם באופן זמני או קבוע, עכשיו אפשר לנחש שהמספרים האמיתיים יותר גבוהים, אנשים לא כל כך רוצים לשתף פעולה, הם לא יודעים מי בצד השני של הטלפון, או במקרה הזה של הטלפון החכם.
וגם יש דעת קהל עולמית שרואה בזה צעד מאוד בעייתי, ומדברים במונחים של טרנספר.
תלוי באיזה צעד. אם זה הגירת עבודה, לא תראי אף אחד בעולם שיוצא נגד זה. אם מדובר בבעלי דרכונים זרים למשל, סתם לסבר את האוזן, מתוך 1,700,000 עזתים, 200 עד 250,000 הם או בני משפחותיהם בעלי דרכונים זרים. כל האנשים האלה יכולים לצאת בלי שמישהו יצייץ. עכשיו, אני אגיד לך מה ההבדל בין ההשקפה הזאת לבין ההשקפה של טראמפ. טראמפ, לכאורה, עד שלא יוצא עזתי האחרון, לא יעשה כלום. בעיניי, אם 250,000, 300,000 עזתים עוזבים, תקראי לזה עבודה, תקראי לזה דרכונים זרים, תקראי לזה ייאוש או טיפול רפואי, זה הישג אדיר, okay. זאת נקבה שנייה מבחינתם, וזה העיתות. אתם רציתם שבערי ונירוז וכפר עזה יעזבו, בסוף ג'באליה ושג'אייה וחניונס עזבו.
What is the occupation's goal in promoting the migration of Palestinians from Gaza?
Well, that has been their objective since 1948. I mean, since before 1948. This is a Zionist project, is to push people out of their land. Now, this man is justifying mass crime. He's justifying genocide. He's justifying displacement. He's not recognizing the basic rights to their own land, the basic rights to people for self-determination, which is an international law. Mm-hmm. He's saying that 250,000 of the Palestinians have foreign passports. Is that what he's saying? Mm-hmm. There are 5 million Israelis. They are all Europeans from Ukraine and from Poland and from the United States and from France and from Morocco and Yemen and other countries. And he's saying that out of the inhabitants of Gaza, there are 250,000.
Okay, and you're an expert on criminal justice. What is the legal perspective from this, Dr.
Well, this
Ahmad?
Is an international crime. It's very clear. I mean, Gaza is part of the state of Palestine that is recognized in the United Nations as an entity. These people have the right to self-determination. They have the right to exist as a people. I mean, this is really flagrant.
Do you think that that's obvious now to the world, that the Israelis do not perceive the Palestinians as people that have the rights that you're highlighting?
Well, not just the Israelis.
The legal rights.
Well, not just the Israelis and everyone who supports the Israelis in that sense, and some of the Arabs who support the Israelis as well. I mean, there's no respect for human dignity for these people in Gaza. They just think that slaughtering them and kicking them out of their homes and killing their children on Eid is a right for the Israelis and those who support them. I mean, the problem is not just with the
Israelis. So the resumption of killings and genocide is for that perspective, in your opinion, to push towards migration, your opinion.
Exactly, and that's not just the problem of the Israelis. That's the problem of those who support them. That's the problem of the Arab and Islamic world that is watching this and doing nothing about it.
Israeli social media are well engaged with the media campaign to displace Gaza residents. Here are some comments from the Zionist activists.
Dor Henet Sahon. They want to leave, so let them leave. An immigration directorate has been established in Israel. The president of the world's greatest power, Trump, supports us. Norwit Yohanan. The amount of fantasy involved in the idea of migration from Gaza is unbelievable. Egypt has denied twice in half a week that it has agreed to migration or to receiving 2 million people from Gaza in Sinai. Amit Malmad. The only way to stop this vicious cycle is to refuse the return of war to Gaza. We've already tried everything. Reject the killing of captive soldiers and the residents of Gaza.
Dr. Ahmad, what grabbed your attention in these comments that we just heard together?
Well, these comments, I mean, what grabbed my attention is that they focus on something that they call migration of Palestinians from Gaza. It's not about migration. There's a kind of a, really, it's a big lie. This is forced displacement. This is ethnic cleansing. This is.
But they said that they agreed that Egypt refuses this migration. Some of the writers.
Yeah,
actually.
But even using the term migration is what caught my attention. And of course, the Egyptians are going to refuse it in public. I mean, we don't know what's happening.
They will agree under the table.
I'm not sure. Well, let's see what they're doing because, you know,
for what
in
benefit?
The past, well, in the past, Egypt has shown a lot of, you know, setback in the negotiations, has shown a lot of, you know, a fear that they would lose the American support. They, you know, you have to remember that Egypt has like billions of dollars of debt and they are having really serious economic problems. And their economic problems started to amplify after they signed the peace talks with the Israelis in Camp David, in fact. You know, but this is how the Israelis function, the Americans. They put these countries
under pressure.
Under immense pressure so that they cannot
But they
come.
Declared it to the public, whether the Jordanian or the Egyptians, that they refuse the plan that Trump actually highlighted.
Well, all the Arab leaders declared in public that they support the Palestinian people. I mean, I haven't heard any Arab country saying things that are, you know, that are similar to the actions of supporting the Israelis or just not doing anything about it when they're committing a genocide for almost 2 years now. This is a genocide. It's the most dangerous of any crime, and it should be rejected. If it's not rejected, well, there's a collapse of the world order. We are witnessing a collapse in the
but
world
Saudi
order.
But Saudi Arabia is calling for a two-state solution, and that's the mission that they're working upon.
Well, it's not enough. These are just words. we need some action. What two-state solution? I mean, what kind of, we need a viable state, a Palestinian viable state. The solution for Palestine is outlined in Imam Ali Khamenei's book, Qadiyat Palestine, very clearly. I mean, there is, I mean, I invite everyone to read that solution.
Okay.
It could be a logical solution, where it could be a baseline to start negotiations if anyone is serious about finding solutions for the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, total victory, a false term Netanyahu has used dozens of times since the beginning of the war of extermination in Gaza. He continues to use it despite failing to achieve it. A military analyst in Hebrew media examined cases where Netanyahu invoked this term. What is the significance of Hebrew media reminding constantly people of Netanyahu's statements, absolute victory, total victory?
Well, because the war is ongoing. I mean, the slaughtering is ongoing. What absolute victory? What absolute victory for the Israeli entity when Israel today, creates more threats to the Jewish people all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Jewish people, you know, wanted to have a state, the state of Israel, so that they can have more security. Now they have less security,
yes.
One. The second thing is that the Palestinian cause wasn't very well known to the whole world before 2023. Today, everybody recognizes the Palestinian flag and the right for the Palestinian people to have their own nation. Palestine is known all over the world more than ever.
And how will these
and
factors
third,
affect the Israelis?
Well, of course it will affect.
Because on their hand, they keep on highlighting, or Netanyahu keep on highlighting, that we will achieve absolute victory and total victory.
I mean, they're committing the biggest
contradiction. They're not aware of all the deficiencies?
They're committing the biggest contradiction ever. You see, the Israeli people have been saying that they are the victims of the Holocaust, they're victim
yes.
of the brutality of the
Europeans.
Calling
for anti-Semitism.
And what they're doing now, is they're doing the exact same thing. You know, they're committing all the crimes that they said that they were victims of these crimes. Now, and they're violating all international law. They're committing genocide all over the world. Everyone can see the pictures. Everyone can see the images. All the arguments to justify this genocide are not strong enough. They're not convincing for the whole world, especially when the slaughtering is ongoing, when they see pictures of kids being slaughtered. I mean, they're trying to prove to the whole world that the Jewish people are the chosen people and they are
okay.
superior to all other people and they have the right to life, whereas the Palestinians, where they have the right to eliminate life and eliminate Palestine, eliminate the right of the Palestinian people to exist.
Yes, massacre them or push for migration, as you were highlighting.
The
whole world is seeing. And now to the internal divisions and disputes within Israel, which intensified after the dismissal of the Shin Bet chief and the cabinet's legal advisor. The divisions deepened with protests and demonstrations in the streets, which, despite their momentum, are unlikely to push Netanyahu to change his policies. Dr. Amar, do you really think that all these disputes that we're seeing now in Israel, divisions and protests that we have never actually, remarkable ones, never seen in Israel before, will actually affect Netanyahu's decision?
I don't think it will affect him. However, I think they are very important. It's very important to look at the core of the disputes within the Israelis themselves. And that dispute started before the genocide started in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
From the
families of the captives?
No, before that.
Okay.
It was a problem over judicial overhaul. And, there was a debate among the Israelis, should we have a state where the law takes precedence or where political interests take precedence? And that is the actual battle. They should realize that the actual Israeli entity cannot exist based on law, cannot exist based on legal premises. This is not a debate. These are criminals. The entity is a criminal entity. They're trying to create a court and a prosecutor and things like that. This debate is at the core of the existence of the entity of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Because this entity cannot exist based on a legal status, you see? So when he removes the chief of the Shin Bet and he decides to replace him with another guy.
And ignore the massive demonstrations and
ignore the massive demonstration, ignore the prosecutor that he calls the prosecutor of the Zionist entity. Try to behave in a way where Netanyahu is trying to tell his people that, you know, Israel can only exist based on bloodshed and genocide. We have to kill other people to exist.
Okay.
We have to slaughter them. We have to violate international law to exist. And it is What he's saying to them, he's saying it is our right as a chosen people, as a Jewish people, as Zionists, to do this. And no one can actually object to that.
Okay.
And the other Israelis are having this illusion and telling him, no, we can have, you know, Israel has the right to exist because it has, it is based on some, you know, on the right for the Jewish people to defend themselves, to have a land for themselves after they've been, you know, they suffered from the Nazi Holocaust.
Okay.
That is completely baseless. And I think what Netanyahu is saying looks more like what the identity of this Zionist entity is all about.
Well, Israeli social media was filled with comments on the dismissal of the Shin Bet chief and Ben-Gvir's demand to imprison him. Here are some of those comments.
Ezer Abar. The number one suspect is Ronen Bar, the head of the Shin Bet. He should be prosecuted, not just resign. Moz Vos. The prime minister of corruption is in charge. The prime minister of liars is in charge. The prime minister